or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And we're trying to get everything adjusted here in the old studio.
You mean the virtual?
In the virtual, yes, in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. That is right. Well, it's been a very big, big week on snow, with snow.
Oh my goodness!
And also with freezing rain.
Mm-hmm.
So today we're going to feature the physics behind freezing rain.
Oh, neat. Good.
And we're also going to talk about when is the best time to make that snowman.
Aha.
See, there's a certain, you can check the temperature, and I'll tell you exactly what temperature you want it to be outside to make the perfect snowman.
Oh, good.
So that's what we're going to be doing today.
In the science laboratory.
Oh, yeah. We're also going to talk a bit about visual perception as it relates to Dressgate.
I've sort of been following this, although I'm kind of bored with it, honestly.
Yeah, but I'm going to talk about
the... Okay, but you'll make it
interesting. I'm going to talk about the physics. I'll talk about the science behind it. Yeah, I've heard all of the arguing back and forth, but we're going to talk about the science behind it. And I've had real examples of this because when I do scuba diving, I noticed that I take one picture with my camera, but my eye actually sees the correct colors, even though it's different. And so your perception actually makes changes to what you see.
Didn't we have an email about this recently?
We did, but mm-hmm. I've actually experienced what's going on and why people are seeing these different things. So it's actually worth talking about because it gets back to perception. And so I thought, okay, I can really handle that. And we're going to, of course, feature the guy who was recommended by Arnie last week. It's the man who is credited with the development of the lithium-ion rechargeable battery.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And, of course, we had a huge, huge mailbag.
Guy Gundis.
Profiles in IT.
Boy, you knew that was going to happen, right?
Oh, boy, that's big. Okay, we got another email from Arnie. He's just really very prolific, I'll tell you. Got an email from Arnie in Crownsville, Maryland. And just a minute here.
Which, did you become unconnected there?
Well, I'm getting a lot of buzz in my ear for some reason. I don't know what's going on with that.
You need an RF filter.
I'll have to work on that off channel.
Yeah.
We got an email from Arnie in Crownsville. Hi, Dr. Schertz. You touched briefly on Tech Talk this morning, something about the FCC ruling. It's still very confusing to me and probably also to others. Hopefully you can go over this FCC ruling more in detail. I'd like a free market rather than the government. But since the FCC's made their move, what's next, Arnie in Crownsville? Well, Arnie, I did talk about that last week. Here is the real issue, and I'm going to talk more in detail about it in the show, but this is the issue in a nutshell. There's tension between the telecoms and the internet content giants like Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Netflix. Now, the telecoms don't want to be treated like just a commodity provider of bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
They want to share in the economic boom that's known as the internet, with all of the streaming content and all of the e-commerce and all of the other things that are going on. On the other hand, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Netflix and the like, which provide content, they say, look, we want to make money on the internet, but we want you telecom guy, you just be the pipe. You stay out of our business. So they're really fighting over who is going to generate revenue from internet commerce, whether it's going to be the telecoms or the providers. And that's what's going on now. And so the finding last week where the FCC said that internet service providers would be treated under Title II of the Communications Act of 1934 says that the internet service providers are just going to be treated as dumb pipes and that they really can't make any money from the internet. I don't think the government, through government regulation, should pick the winner and loser here. I think the marketplace should do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the sort of it from a global nutshell, so to speak, Arnie. And I'll talk a little bit about this later on in the show. We got an email from Tung in Ohio. Oh, another
uh-oh.
Ohio deal, yeah.
And it involves pictures.
Yeah. Dear Doc and Jim, we take a lot of digital pictures. Whoops. My husband loves to photograph still life. His last photo sequence was devoted strictly to carrots. I guess he's like taking carrots in different scenes or something. I don't know what this is all about.
I don't even want to know.
What's the best way to print and display and save them? This has become a major challenge, and the number of pictures has climbed. Love the show, Tung in Ohio. Well, Tung, first of all, saving pictures is your first challenge. They must be stored in two locations. Could be an external hard drive in your computer's hard drive. It could be your computer's hard drive and cloud backup. Now, I like to use Carbonite, but you could also use Dropbox. You could use Google Drive. You could use Apple iCloud. You could use Microsoft OneDrive. But you want to have them backed up two places. So many times people think, oh, I've got all these pictures. I'll back them up to this external hard drive so then I can delete them from my computer. But then they're only on one place, so they're really not backed up. They have to be two places to be backed up. Now, I would also print pictures. I'm telling you, digital pictures have turned into the digital black hole. Have you ever seen, you've seen people, they take pictures of everything, and nobody ever sees them again. They never print them. They don't look at them. They're just gone. It's a digital black hole. This is a big problem, actually. And it's even a bigger problem is that people's memories are tied up in this digital black hole, and they're just hoping that they won't be lost.
Mm-hmm.
So the advice is you ought to print your pictures so that in the event catastrophe strikes, you've still got prints of those pictures. Now, prints will last forever, and they're not subject to digital death. Now, what is digital death? Like you get a certain picture format, it takes a certain software package to read that particular file. So what happens if in the future the formats change, you don't have the particular way to read it, then you've got to go back and figure out how to do it. So it's better just to print them and make certain that you always have them in the future, even 50 years from now, because you never know. These carrot pictures could actually be classics. You don't really know what's going to happen there. Now, as for actually displaying them, there are a number of things that you could do that are pretty good to get pictures out of the digital black hole. Now, I like the idea of a Wi-Fi picture frame. For instance, you can get an 18-inch picture frame. That's 18 inches by 11 inches from NixPlay. It's a Wi-Fi cloud digital photo frame, and it's around, if you get the 8-inch frame, which would be 6 by 8, it's around $100. If you get the Wi-Fi frame that's 18 by 11, it's about $250. Well, this attaches to the Wi-Fi network. So then what you do is you just upload, your last vacation, you just upload maybe 50 pictures from the last location to the cloud storage that this particular unit connects to. And they will be displayed on that digital frame. It just rotated through the digital frame. This digital frame will synchronize up to 12 frames. Up to 12 frames can be synchronized with this free cloud account. So, for instance, if you've got a grandparent that would like to see the pictures, but they can't really log on, they can't open their email, you could actually give them a digital frame, and it would sync up to that same cloud storage thing, and they could then look at pictures at their house. They would just, they're rotating through automatically. Now, this particular frame has a motion sensor, so when nobody's in the room, it doesn't show anything. You walk in the room, it starts going through the thing.
Interesting.
See, that's a very nice way to display pictures. I think with this digital black hole, we've got to start figuring out ways to get the pictures displayed. I think it's a real issue. Now, you could also print them. Now, there are just a lot of online printing. I mean, printing is, you can print online. They'll send them to you. I started using Costco to print online because they're, well, face it, they're cheap.
Okay.
but the quality's pretty good. It's pretty good. Now, for instance, and what I particularly like, you can print on canvas. And you can make it, and you can make it look like a piece of art.
I have done this.
So, like, I could print a 24-inch by 32-inch canvas, which is wrapped around the frame, like museum mounting.
Mm-hmm.
24-inch by 32-inch is only $60.
And they do that at Costco.
Yeah.
I see. I've had this done at Ritz, but I don't think Ritz exists anymore.
No. They do that at Costco. Now, you also could do, they also, Costco does panels. Like, suppose you take one picture and spread it across three panels.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you want to have three panels, you know, above the couch.
Right.
Okay, so you could get a 56-inch by 36-inch three-panel set for $219.
That's not bad.
That is really good. And so my recommendation, you guys that are taking all these digital pictures and putting them in the digital black hole, let people see them.
Exactly.
Get a Wi-Fi frame and share them with friends and family. You could give these Wi-Fi frames, and then everybody could look at them. Then, secondly, start printing out selectively very high quality, prints on canvas, and then you can start showing them. So this was a great question, and I think this is a problem that many, many people have of the digital picture black hole.
I wonder how many of the pictures being taken in Ohio are actually suitable for framing, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, that is another question,
mm-hmm.
which is beyond the scope
yes.
of this show.
We just handle technology
and leave
you to your own devices.
Exactly. We got an email from Hawk and Bowie. Dear Tech Talk, I'd like to watch Netflix at home. However, my TV does not have an internet connection. Now, I do have Wi-Fi, but no way to get it to my TV. What are my options? Love the show. Hawk in Bethesda. Okay, this is the thing. There are several options, Hawk, that you can do to get Wi-Fi to your TV. First of all, you're trying to get a streaming device connected to your TV. Now, you could actually plug in something directly into your TV, to your HDMI port of your TV. You got Google Chromecast, which is a dongle that you could plug into your TV.
Mm-hmm.
It will connect to your Wi-Fi connection, and you can stream things like Netflix to your TV through Chromecast. That's $35. Now, I went on Amazon one time and got mine for $28. So occasionally it's cheaper than $35, but normally it's $35. If you're an Apple fan, you might want to get Apple TV, and then it integrates with your iPad and your iMac, and you can have all kinds of slideshows. So Apple fans like Apple TV, and it's a small box that plugs into the HDMI port of your TV. That's around $99. It's Wi-Fi enabled. Some people like Roku. It's another dongle. It plugs into the HDMI port of the thing. Now, people like Roku, you can watch Netflix and different content through Roku, but Roku has a very nice remote control, so you can activate it. So for people that are, you know, technology challenged, Roku many times is a little bit easier to use. So those are your three options if you just want to plug into the HDMI port of your TV. Now, there are other options too. Suppose that your TV doesn't have an HDMI port because you've got an old TV.
Right.
Now that could be a problem. So you actually then have to attach some other device to the TV that's connected to the internet. So everybody has a DVD player or a Blu-ray player. So the new DVD and Blu-ray players have Wi-Fi connection built in, and they're about $100. So you could get a DVD Blu-ray thing, and you just plug that into the video channel of your computer, and then you send the sound off to wherever your sound is being played, and you can then get your complete package. And so you play DVD through that player. You can connect through a web page which is built into the DVD Blu-ray player, and then you can attach to Netflix, and you can play all your Netflix things right through that. Now, if you're a gamer and you've got Xbox or PlayStation 2, those also have Wi-Fi connection, but they're a little bit more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like in the basement, my son was on. He always liked Xbox many years ago, so my internet connection in the basement is through the Xbox. Now, my internet connection in the kitchen, because that's a TV that didn't have internet on it, is through Chromecast. Now, my main TV in the TV room, I just got a smart TV, and it has Wi-Fi built into it. So that's your third option. So I'm actually doing all three options at home. Your third option is you get a smart TV. Wi-Fi is built right into it. You can get a smart TV, which with 1080p, which 1080 progressive, that would be HD quality. It's less than $1,000, and they're coming down. But I got the 4K TV, the new Ultra HD TV, and you can get an Ultra HD TV, which has 4,000 horizontal lines. It has four times the resolution vertically of HD. It's called Ultra HD, and those you can get for less than $2,000, and mm-hmm. those prices are dropping fast. So those are all your options, Hawk. You've got the devices that plug directly in the HDMI port. You've got the external devices, either a DVD player or an Xbox player, and then, of course, you could just get a new TV, a smart TV. Those are all your options, and you go from all the way from $35 up to $2,000. We got an email from Andrea in Falls Church. Dear Doc and Jim, I've been asked to create a website for my employer, and I don't have enough pictures for the site. I can find lots of pictures on the internet, but I don't own them. And my employer does not want me to steal pictures. Very good.
That's a wise idea.
He's giving you very good advice. What are my options? I mean, we've got kind of a low budget, got less than $1,000 for all the pictures. I listen every weekend, Andrea in Falls Church. Well, Andrea, that's a good question, and I think your employer's right on track. You don't want to steal the pictures, you want to buy them. And you want to buy them royalty-free. Very important. And so there are a number of royalty-free sites that are out there. You've got iStockPhoto.com is one. You've got Shutterstock.com, that's one. You've got GettyImages.com, that's one. You've got Photolia.com, and then you've got BigStockPhoto.com. Those are five. Now, I've used iStockPhoto for years and love it. It's the kind of pictures that we need for our promotions at Stratford. But each of these sites has a different pictures, a different selection of pictures, different photographers. So you might find one site is better than another based on the kind of pictures that you need. Now, the nice thing is you can buy a picture which is suitable for web resolution for less than a dollar or $2. And then if you're going to then make a brochure or something, you need a high-resolution picture, you can also buy a high-resolution version of the same picture for maybe $10. So that's a very nice way for you to handle an integrated media campaign and always buy your pictures. So I'll have all of those websites listed in the show outline that we'll post to the web in a couple of days. There's also another idea. This is if there are any photographers out there. These websites are a great place for you to sell your photographs. Basically, photographers upload their photos to these websites, and they set the price that they want for them, and they can sell photos. And what this does, this would allow you to see what the public likes in the way of your photos, and it would inform you as to how to do additional photos. So I'm telling you, if you're a photographer and you got a lot of photos around, I'd upload to one of these sites and just see what the interest is of people who'd want to buy your photos. We got an email from Brian in Kansas. Dear Tech Talk, I love computers, and I want to learn about programming. What programming languages are in demand? I'm in high school now, but after college, I want to become a developer at a tech company. I listen to your podcast every week, Brian in Kansas. Well, Brian, at Stratford, all of our students have access to a site called Lynda, LYNDA.com. Lynda, it's a great site with a lot of tutorials on it. And they have a whole boatload of programming tutorials that we make available free to all of our students. And you can actually join Lynda if you want. It's not much if you join it as just an individual. So I've compiled a list of the 10 most sought-after programming languages according to the amount of usage and requests they get on Lynda. Now, here are the top 10. Number one, Java. Now, Java is a class-based object-oriented programming language developed by Sun Microsystems in the 1990s. It's one of the most in-demand programming languages, and it supports multiple platforms. Number two is the C language. C is a general-purpose programming language developed in the early 70s. It was actually the language that we used to write the Unix operating system. C is the oldest and most widely used language. because it provides a foundation for other languages. Many people learn that one first, and then they learn C++, which was sort of a follow-on. The number three language is C++. This is getting more difficult to learn now. It's an intermediate-level language. It's object-oriented, and it was designed to enhance the features of C. That's why it's called C++. And it powers major software like Firefox, Winamp, and Adobe programs. C Sharp, that would be C with the little, what's that, numbers hashtag.
Right, yeah,
that
pound sign.
Pound sign, yeah, C pound sign, pronounced C Sharp.
Or they do call it a hashtag now. I'm dating myself, aren't I?
Yeah, it's a hashtag now, but yeah, in the old days it was something else. C Sharp is a language that was developed by Microsoft as part of its .NET initiative. So people that want to program for the Microsoft platform and stay in the .NET ecosystem love C Sharp. So that was the programming language number four in the list from Linda. Now, number five is Objective-C. Now, that's a general-purpose, object-oriented programming language. It's used by Apple. See, because if Microsoft has got one, Apple wants one.
Mm-hmm.
So Objective-C, it powers the Apple's operating system X. It powers iOS, as well as all their APIs. It can be used to create phone apps. So people that want to get into the Apple phone app business, you know, they want to learn Objective-C. PHP is a hypertext preprocessor. It's a free server-wide scripting language designed for dynamic websites. So a lot of websites have PHP where you can interact with them. The PHP can grab data and display it, can change the page dynamically depending on what data you request. PHP powers more than 200 million websites, including WordPress, Dig, and Facebook. So it's a if you want to become a website developer, PHP is the go-to language. Python is a high-level server-side scripting language for websites and mobile apps. It's considered an easy language for beginners. It powers websites like Instagram, Pinterest, Radio. It's used by Google, Yahoo, and NASA. Ruby. Now we're down to number eight. Ruby is a dynamic, object-oriented scripting language for developing websites and mobile apps. Ruby was designed to be simple and easy to write. It powers Ruby on Rails, or something just called Rails. It's used for Scribd, GitHub, Groupon, Shopify. You want to pick one of these. You don't have to learn them all. SQL is a great language, a structured query language. That's a multipurpose language for talking to relational databases. So if you've heard of Oracle, That's an SQL database. So all of the big databases are basically SQL. And so if you can program SQL, you can write queries, you can be very efficient at generating reports. So that's number 10 on the list. It's a great question. There are tutorials on Lynda for learning all of these. Just pick one and learn it. That's the best way to do it. We got an email from Ian in Greenbelt. Dear Tech Talk, whenever I receive an email, images are downloaded.
Not downloaded.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I get this message. Some pictures have been blocked to prevent the sender from identifying your computer. Click here to download the pictures. Now, how does blocking the image download protect my privacy? Enjoy the show, Ian and Greenbelt. Well, Ian, there are two types of images in an email. One, they're attached, and the other one is remote. The attached email is exactly what you think. It's actually attached to the email, and when you read the email, you just see it immediately. But then that makes the email bigger and slower to download. And then the person that sent it never really knows whether you looked at the image or not. Now, the other kind is actually remote, and they just have a link to the picture. So you download the image, and then there's a link to a remote image. And then that link would download the image. Now, here's the thing. With spam operators, they love to know whether you're looking at that email. So what they do, they track whether you've downloaded an image. And if you've downloaded an image, they say, hey, that's a good email. Let's just send them more spam. So what you want to do is you want to block the spam. You want to block the image download for spammers. So what I do is, but maybe they're different businesses that you work with and you trust them. So you can put them on your white list, so to speak, and they will automatically download those images. But if they're not on the white list, they're not going to be downloaded unless you click yes. And so whenever it's a spam item, I never click yes, and I just delete it. And then they don't know whether I've looked at the email or not. And I'll tell you, this is exactly what we do. We used to send out emails. We sent out emails through Constant Comment, which was a sort of an email blast device. And I would get back a report on exactly what links had been activated and looked at. So I would know what the activity was on that. So all of these guys that are using, you know, sending out spam to you, they're tracking in the background exactly what you're doing. And so it's very wise just to block all downloads unless you really want to do that. Listen, we love all your emails.
We do indeed.
Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll cover your emails on the air. Or else we may actually write to you directly if it's like an emergency. And we also love you to check out our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/techtalkonline and leave any comments, and we may cover them in the show.
It is Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and 1039 FM HD2. We'll be back with more right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn by doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're featuring John Bannister Goodenough. I do like that
name. I like that last name.
Goodenough, yeah.
I like the whole name, actually. It's very classy.
John Bannister Goodenough. John Bannister Goodenough is an American physicist widely credited with the development of the lithium-ion rechargeable battery.
Ooh.
He was suggested by Arnie last week. Goodenough was born July 25th, 1922 in Jena, Germany. John Goodenough grew up near New Haven, Connecticut, where his father, Erwin, was a scholar in history of religion at Yale. Now, John's mother actually never wanted a second child, and so she actually wasn't very friendly with John at all.
Oh, no.
She didn't want him.
So she just called him, "Hey, you."
Yeah, so I think maybe only his dad called him John Bannister. I don't think his mom called him much. So when John was 12, they sent him off to... They sent him off to a private boarding school in Groton, Massachusetts. And John rarely heard from his parents again. While
wow.
he was at boarding school, they only communicated with him one time.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, John, the thing is, I love people who overcome adversity. This is why I really like this story. He suffered from dyslexia. Mm. And when he was at Groton, he had trouble reading. He had trouble understanding his lessons. I mean, apparently it was a religious school because he had trouble keeping up with in chapel, reading the things in chapel. And so he had to struggle to overcome his problem with dyslexia. And back then they really didn't know what dyslexia was, so they didn't really know how to treat it. Well, he managed on his own, without any outside support, to figure out how to overcome this problem. And everything came together near the end of his activities there at the boarding school, and without any help from his parents. And he actually received a scholarship to Yale University.
Wow.
If you can imagine.
That's amazing.
He received a bachelor in mathematics from Yale University in 1944, graduating summa cum laude.
Mm.
Now that is an impressive feat.
Yeah.
You know, that's an impressive feat. And after World War II, Goodenow, well, then he after he graduated, he got his bachelor's in mathematics, he went into the Army. And after World War II, in the Army, he was actually stationed somewhere in along a beach, it was quite a nice area where he was stationed. He got a telex, which ordered him to Washington, D.C. It turned out that educators had stumbled on some unspent budget money. Of course, there's unspent money. Let's just spend it. Yeah, that's right. That's the philosophy there. You don't want to lose your budgeted money. And they advocated sending 20 young returnees back to graduate school to study physics and math. So they sent him to the University of Chicago to study physics. And now, Chicago is where all the physics luminaries were, like Edward Teller and Enrico Fermi. You know, these are the people that were really behind the development of the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
They were nuclear physicists. So, and he said, I couldn't figure out why they would send me. They said, he never took any science classes as an undergraduate. And when he checked into it, it turned out that his math teacher at Yale had recommended him. And based on the recommendation of his math teacher at Yale, he was one of these 21 guys. So he ended up getting his Ph.D. in physics from the University of Chicago in 1952. Look how he did this on his own without any help from his parents. Mm. I mean, it's just an incredible story. After he obtained his doctorate in 1952, he went to work at MIT's Lincoln Lab, and there he helped develop the ferrimagnetic memory cores of the first random access memory for a digital computer. Remember, they used to have this RAM, and these were like little ferrimagnetic rings that had wires wrapped around. They just have hundreds of these things, and those became the first random access memory. They were huge. Now we're used to solid-state devices, but back then they didn't have that. So he worked on that, and that actually was a big breakthrough because it was a much faster memory access than they had before. He stayed there at MIT until 1976, and then he continued his work by moving to Oxford University, and he became head of the inorganic chemistry lab at Oxford. Now, while he was at Oxford, he started working on this lithium oxide battery deal. A battery needs an anode, they need a cathode, and they need some kind of electrolyte to carry the current between them. So that was always the deal. And somebody had figured out that you could actually use lithium ions in a solid state material, and the solid state material could function as the electrolyte, and these lithium ions could actually travel through the device like a battery. But you needed a cathode that could store the lithium ions until they were released as the battery was being discharged. So he got the idea that he could have lithium along with cobalt and oxygen. So he'd have a cobalt-oxygen cathode with lithium, you know, stored in it. So it was lithium X, cobalt oxide 2, cobalt dioxide. And so he developed this as a very good cathode material of choice, and that turned out to be the best cathode material possible. So his research guys worked on this thing, and they developed this thing. It turned out then that the Japanese Sony took his cathode and they combined it with a carbon anode, and they made the first commercial rechargeable battery based on his invention. So you would think, man, John is going to be a rich dude. You know, he was the guy that invented the key technology for the lithium-ion battery. Here's the deal. He was at the laboratory, and they did not want to patent it.
Really?
They said, you know, the chemistry lab at Oxford, they said, you know, you know, why patent this thing? What could come out of that? So they didn't want to patent it. And he ended up signing away his rights to the lithium-ion battery to the Atomic Energy Research Establishment in the UK. He didn't get a penny for this. Now, 1982, so that was his first, the lithium cobalt oxide, you know, cathode. Then he had he worked with then a postdoc, Mike Thackeray. And he and Mike Thackeray came up with a second cathode, which had magnesium in it. It was a structure called Spinel, and so it was magnesium cathode. And it was cheaper and it was safer than the cobalt oxide one. So that was his second major breakthrough, and that also became a commercial success, for which he received nothing. So. In 1986, after spending 10 years there at the Chem Lab of Oxford, he was hired by the University of Texas in Austin, and his group came up with the third variation of a cathode material for the lithium-ion battery, which was lithium ferrite potassium oxide. This was the third item. Now, what happened was, so he was a little bit wise to this whole patent deal by then. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that just as he was beginning to work on this new cathode material, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone came up with the idea that they would fund a researcher in his lab. So they paid for a research guy to work with him in the lab while he was working on this new cathode material, this new cathode material that had iron, that was based on iron and phosphorus. Because this was actually the third breakthrough in lithium-ion battery. So it turned out that this guy was a spy.
Whoa.
And he was secretly sending the information to Nippon, and they were developing this thing in their own labs and filing secretly their own patents. So when Goodenough heard about this, he just hit the roof. He said,
wow.
He said, you know, I might have been duped two times, but I'm not going to be duped a third time.
Mm-hmm.
So University of Texas filed a $500 million lawsuit against Nippon Telegraph and Telephone, and they ended up settling for $30 million. And yet again, Goodenough got nothing.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, jeez. At University of Texas at Austin, he also recently identified a ceramic anode material for solid-state oxide fuel cells that could operate on natural gas. So he basically is a solid-state physicist, and he really got great joy out of doing these things. Now, he came up with his first idea when he was 57.
Mm-hmm.
His first breakthrough on lithium-ion batteries when he was 57. He's now 92. And he's got the next great idea, because he said he's not done with batteries. This is the thing. He doesn't think that the batteries that Elon Musk is developing for the Tesla have enough energy density. And he said that's not going to make it.
Really?
They need 5 to 10 times more energy density.
Mm-hmm.
He has an idea.
Jeez.
At 92. And his goal is to have one more breakthrough. But when he talked, I watched the interview, and he says, you know, this time it's a secret.
That's amazing.
So fourth time, maybe he's going to get a patent on this little booger.
That is incredible. That's what a story.
And so there he is at age 92, still actively working in the lab there at University of Texas. Now, he received the prestigious Japan Prize in 2001. This is a big deal for his development on lithium-ion battery, and also the Presidential Enrico Fermi Award in 2009. So there's a guy, John Bannister Goodenough, the man behind the lithium-ion battery and the improved lithium-ion battery, and maybe the next improvement in lithium-ion battery.
That is an incredible story. Hope you were paying attention, because that knowledge could win you free food when you play the pop quiz coming up here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. Stand by. The pop quiz is up next.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the Classroom of the Airways. And of course, if it's a classroom, there's going to be a pop quiz, which we call assessment in the education field.
I understand.
Yes. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you'll win two tickets to Fine Dining at the Escoffier Dining Room, the Carême Dining Room, and you'll also get an A-plus for this section. Earlier in the show, we talked about John Bannister Goodenough. He, of course, was the man behind the lithium-ion rechargeable battery. But when he was just starting out life, and when he was at the boarding school, he had serious learning problems that he ultimately overcame. What was his learning problem?
Well, if you know the answer to that question, you need to get us that answer immediately. If you're calling from west of Jena, Germany, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of New Haven, Connecticut, it's 877-936-9333. Calling from anywhere else on the global planet we call Earth, it's 877-936-9333. We also call that the wild card line. But,
that's
Doc,
right.
I'm sure there's a more high-tech
that's
way.
That's right. If you're on the International Space Station, you can reach us using Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and we'll forward you directly to the studio.
They could hear us on the International Space Station, couldn't they?
Yeah, of course they could. And I'm quite certain that they are listening.
And
this is like cutting-edge technology.
And they're sitting there going, oh, we should have done that.
That's right.
That's why that didn't work.
So let's talk about how to build the best snowman in your neighborhood. This is very important now because the snow's out there. Now, the key is start with good snow.
Well, there's that.
Now the snow needs to be slightly wet and not slushy. It's the kind of snow you get when it's just above or below freezing. So you can look at the temperature. So like if it's around freezing, around 32 degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to be good snow.
Mm-hmm.
If it's like 5 degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to be too powdery. It's not going to be good snow. And if it's 40 degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to be too slushy. So watch the temperature. When it's 30 to 34 degrees in that range, it's going to be the perfect snow. That's also, I don't like to ski in that kind of snow because the snow is really a little too heavy. Mm-hmm. I like it either packed down or I like it
powdery.
Powdery. I don't like this heavy snow.
Why not?
Because it grabs your ski.
Oh.
It grabs your ski, and it could break your leg.
Well, that's a good point.
That's
I've
right.
never skied. If I did, it would be the last time I ever
that's
did.
That's right. Now, the other thing you need to keep track of is you need at least 4 inches of snow out there. Otherwise you're going to roll up a bunch of dirt in your snowman. So first of all, you want to make your balls. And so what you do, you start with a big snowball.
Are you back on Deflategate again?
No, we're not going to do that. No, you make a snowball and you pack it up in your hands and then you start rolling it on the ground.
Ah.
And you keep rolling it until it gets bigger. Now, the thing is, you've got to roll in different directions. If you just roll in one direction, you get a cylinder.
Mm,
so you want to
right.
roll. You want to roll in different directions to make it round.
Oh, good point.
You can make it as big as you want. Now, the key is, though, you've got to lift the second ball. It's normally made with three balls, so you got to lift the second one up. So if you make it too big, you may not be able to lift the second ball up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the bottom ball is going to be biggest. You want to flatten it on the top so it doesn't roll off.
Sure.
And now some people make their snowmen so big that they can't actually lift the body up, the second ball up. So they actually put a little ramp up. They'll get like a board and they'll roll it
it's
up.
It's like building a pyramid.
Yeah, so they'll roll it up and they'll kind of flatten that one down. And then finally you've got to lift the head up, which is the deal. Now, this is the key. It's if you want your snowman to last, put it more in the shade. So like if your house is like has some shade against the sun or something, put it in an area that will be shady. It will last longer.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you may want to have your snowman not looking at where the sun is because you don't want the
face is going to melt.
You don't
off.
Want the face to be melting. And so and so what you can do is you can use, you know, the classic carrot. You can use a carrot for the nose. And you can use, they always used to say use coal for the eyes and the buttons and the mouth. But, you know, people don't have coal anymore.
No, they really don't.
What I've discovered is charcoal.
I was just going to say charcoal bricks, right?
You could have charcoal bricks would work, or actually rocks work, too.
There's a good point.
You just go out to rock. So there you go. Everything you want to know about building the best snowman in the neighborhood.
There you go. Okay, we have a bunch of people on the phone. Let us go to... June, who is calling us from somewhere in Virginia. June, good morning. And how are you? I think I have you there.
Okay.
Hang on a second. June, there you are. June, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Hi there. Okay. Which? Where are you calling us from, Virginia?
Burke.
Burke. Okay. Dr. Church
okay.
asked the question.
Early in the show, June, we talked about John Bannister Goodenough, and he had a learning problem. What was that learning problem?
It was dyslexia.
That is correct. You'll win two tickets to Fine Dine, the Escoffier Durham. Very good.
Excellent. June, thank you. This you've never called us before, have you?
I never have called, no.
Well, thank you for listening. How long have you been a listener?
A long time.
Excellent.
I love listening. It gives me good things for my job, too. So.
That's great. Well, you and the guys on the International Space Station.
That's
June,
right.
Thanks for listening. Hang on for a second. Andrew Mitchell, we'll take your information and get your prizes right out to you. This is Tech Talk Radio, and in fact, you are listening on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. We'll have more of Tech Talk Radio coming up in just a moment.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Let's talk a little bit about the science of freezing rain.
Yes.
Because we've had a lot of that this last week.
We have.
And freezing rain is actually one of the most dangerous weather conditions if, in fact, you're driving,
mm-hmm.
and it can paralyze cities. Now, actually, why is it actually raining when the temperatures are, you know, are below freezing? What's actually going on? This is what's called freezing rain. So what what happens is that there's a shallow layer of cold temperature just near the surface, which is below freezing. But just above that shallow layer that is freezing, below freezing, there's a region where it's above freezing, and so it's actually rain until it just gets down to the very, almost to the ground, and then it hits the freezing temperatures just before it hits. And the water becomes super cooled. And it's still water, but it's super cooled, and as soon as it hits something, it freezes.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have this rain coming down. The water will be super cooled by this thin layer of air, which is below the freezing temperature. And once it hits the pavement, it's a solid sheet of ice. Or if it's a tree, the ice just sticks directly to the tree.
Or wires.
Or wires.
Or a fence. Anything.
And it turns out that the weight of this ice can be 500 pounds on a tree, and it can topple trees. It can bring down wires. It causes enormous infrastructure damage. And the roads are solid ice. So if you get freezing rain and all of a sudden try to drive home, chances are you're not going to make it.
Nope.
So that's one of the most dangerous areas. Now, you've got other things that could happen. You'll just get rain, of course, if there's no thin layer, which is below 32 degrees. You'll get sleet if, in fact, the area which is below 32 degrees goes up to quite a high altitude, so that the rain, instead of just being super cooled, actually freezes before it hits the ground. So if the freezing occurs before it hits the ground, it's sleet. If it's just
ice pellets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, of course, if it's below freezing all the way up, you'll just get snow. So there you go. You got snow, sleet, freezing rain, or rain, depending on how the items are operating. And freezing rain is the worst. It was a topic because we just had some freezing rain.
You know, sleet and hail get confused.
Tell me about that. What's the difference between sleet and hail?
Hail happens in thunderstorms, and pretty much only in thunderstorms. Hail are balls of ice that form because of the great temperature differential within a thunderstorm, which mm-hmm. is why there is a thunderstorm in the first place.
Uh-huh.
It shoots an ice pellet out the top of the thunderstorm, which begins to melt on the way down. So you've got this ball of ice, which on the inside is basically water because it mm-hmm. started to melt a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So hail is the product generally of just a thunderstorm.
Okay. And then what is sleet? Then sleet
is... sleet is what you just described. It's either rain
mm-hmm.
or snow that is melted on the way down that refreezes before it hits the surface.
Okay.
So
very
there we go.
Very interesting to know. Because...
I know. I think people just drove off the road out of interest.
So now let's talk about Dressgate.
Yes.
A little bit. I mean, there has been all this social media stuff. We'll talk a bit about the thing. Now, there was this shop in Birmingham which actually had a dress that was, blue and black or some dress, and they sold the dress to Cecilia Bleasdale, and she sent a picture to her daughter Grace to say how it'd be great to wearing the dress, and then she and her daughter each saw the dress as a different color. One saw gold and white, and one saw black and blue or something. They saw different two colors, and then they just couldn't agree on it. They shared this with social media, and it went viral. Now, here's the thing. Scientists have looked at this, and it's an illusion that occurs because of how the brain is wired to see color. See, colors are just a perception made by the brain when light hits the back of the retina at differing wavelengths, and the brain interprets these wavelengths as color. But it's doing something very clever. It actually adjusts it based on the illuminations that's shining on it. So like if you see a white surface in a shadow, the brain knows that the shadow has changed the color of that because there are different colors of light shining on it. And the brain adjusts for that automatically so that even though the white is in the shadow, it looks white to you because your brain has made this perceptual change. So, and this actually happens to me. If I go diving, And when I'm diving and I look around at the colors underwater, I see the colors because my brain is automatically adjusting for the fact that red is being filtered out of the by the water, and things look on average bluer. And so it's making that adjustment. And I see the colors because my brain has made an adjustment. But when I take a picture, all the pictures look very, very blue. And I've got to actually manually do that color adjustment. So what happened here is that some people's brains interpret the blue color as a shadow on the white dress. So their mind just says, okay, that must be a shadow on a white dress. So it's not really blue. It's actually a shadow on a white dress, and so they just make that adjustment. Now, other people discount the shadow, and they see the blue and the black as the true color. So it's purely perceptual. Now, Andrew Hansen, the past chair of the color group of Great Britain, said that humans have been, through evolution, are programmed to think objects in the shadow are blue. We've sort of been programmed to do that. And the amount of adjustment that different people see sort of depends on their eye-brain connection and how they've processed it. Now, there's another factor, and that's the color temperature of the background, and that's confusing people. So different screens have different color temperatures. So, in fact, you may have two different displays, and it could look white and gold on one and blue and black on the other, just because of different color temperatures on those two screens. And so that's actually a difference in the adjustment on the screen. But two people could look at the same screen and see different colors because of this perception difference. So there you go, just a little bit about perception. And
pretty interesting.
It was actually quite interesting. And I'll tell you, you start looking around, and your eye is very good at adjusting for the reflected color temperature and making an adjustment to see what it believes is the true color of what you're looking at. So there you go. Dress gate revealed.
Okay.
Now let's talk about Vint Cerf, the plan to future-proof computers. Vint Cerf, of course, the father of the Internet, raised the possibility that centuries from now, file formats will become obscure and unreadable. I mean, I had a problem. I was looking at something I had 30 years ago. I couldn't find anything that I could read it with. And it was like it took a huge job because the programs I had that could read it would not load on the current operating system. And it was like a major job to get the thing done. So what he recommended is that you actually do something which you call wrap all of your pictures around what he calls a digital vellum. And you have everything you need to completely look at the file. So you wrap around, you say your pictures, you wrap around a picture viewer, and around that you wrap the operating system. So you got a complete package of everything you need to view that particular photo. So that 100 years from now, somebody could then, using that digital vellum, they could look at the picture because embedded in that file format are all the applications needed to read the zeros and ones. He said this is really important. So like if you got a Photoshop file, Your digital vellum will include Photoshop. And then if you've got an operating system, of Photoshop represent, you'd have digital vellum around that. And so you would end up having a fully self-contained file that had every single item that you needed. Now, we're already doing that with desktop publishing, where we embed all the fonts that we need. So this is just taking it to the next level. And he also recommended that print those pictures. Listen, We love all these emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and check us out at stratford.edu and say you heard about this on Tech Talk Radio.
And if you tuned in late or would like to hear this program again, it will be rebroadcast in its entirety at 7 o'clock tomorrow. See you next week.
Commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFMHD2 Manassas, WTLPFMHD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO.
Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
We've got the Caps on the air tonight. Pregame at 6:45, puck drops at 7 here on Federal News Radio. Sunny and nice today for a change. High in the mid-40s right now, 31. It's 10 o'clock.
This paid commercial may